The outskirts of Santa Teresa began to speed into view, and I felt an absurd rush of joy at the notion of home. Chapter 10. We found a parking spot for the Porsche 2 doors down from my place and unloaded the trunk. By the time we pushed through the gate and rounded the corner to the rear, Henry had emerged from his back door to welcome me home. He stopped in his tracks, his smile faltering as his eyes shifted from my face to Dietz's. I introduced the two of them, and they shook hands. Belatedly, I remembered what my battered visage must look like. "I was in an accident," I said. "A guy ran me off the road. I had to leave the car in Brawley, and Dietz gave me a ride back." Henry was visibly dismayed, especially as he was in possession of only half the tale.
"Well, who was the fellow? I don't understand. Didn't you file a report with the police down there?"
I hesitated, uncertain how much detail to get into at this point. Dietz settled the matter for me.
"Let's go inside and we'll fill you in on the rest of it."
He was clearly uneasy about standing around in the open air, exposed to view. I unlocked the door and pushed it open, moving into the apartment with Henry behind me and Dietz at the rear, herding us like a sheepdog. "I'll just be a second. I want to get things squared away," I said to Henry, and then to Dietz. "Henry designed the place. It was just finished 2 days ago. I've spent exactly 1 night here." I set my duffel down and cranked open a window to let in some fresh air. The apartment still smelled of sawdust and new carpeting. The space felt like a Barbie doll penthouse in its own carrying case. Scaled-down furniture, built-in spiral staircase, the loft visible above.
"I brought your mail in," Henry said,
his eyes on my guest. He sat down on the couch, perplexed at the liberties Dietz seemed to take. The contrast between the two men was interesting. Henry was tall and lean, the blue eyes in his narrow, tanned face giving him the look of an ascetic, someone otherworldly, aged and wise. Dietz was compact, more muscular, a pit bull of a man with a thick chest and a brazen manner, his face marked by life as if he'd had lessons hammered into him since birth. Henry had a stillness about him where Dietz was restless and energetic, the air around him charged with a curious tension. Dietz circled the place without comment, automatically checking security, such as it was. I had latches on the windows, but not much else. He pulled the shutters closed, checked closets, peered into the downstairs bath. He snapped his fingers, idly popping them against his palms in a gesture that suggested some inner agitation. His manner was authoritative, and Henry shot a look at me to see how I was taking it. I made one of those faces that said, "Your guess is as good as mine, pal." It's not like I enjoyed someone taking over like this, but I wasn't fool enough to protest with my life on the line. I turned my attention to the mail. Most of it looked like junk, but before I could sort it properly, Dietz moved the stack from my hands and set it on the counter.
"Let it be till I can take a look at it," he said.
Henry couldn't stand it.
"What's going on here? I don't understand what this is about."
"Someone's been hired to kill her,"
Dietz said unceremoniously. I don't think I would have been so blunt, but Henry didn't fall backward on the couch in a faint, so maybe he's not as easily upset as I assume. Dietz filled in the picture, laying out the circumstances by which the Carson City DA's office had first gotten wind of Tyrone Patty's assassination plot.
"The police in Carson City are doing what they can to control the situation up there. Obviously, Kinsey's position is a little bit more perilous."
"Why is she here at all?" Henry burst out. "Why not take her someplace out of town?"
"I was out of town," I said, "and what good did it do? 3 people knew where I was going, and the guy was right there. Hell, he even managed to get there before I did at the first rest stop on the road." I told him briefly about spotting my assailant at the rest area near Cabazon.
"There has to be some place," Henry said stubbornly.
"Frankly, I think we're better off here as long as we take a few elementary precautions,"
Dietz said.
"I've got a portable alarm system with me, receiver, siren, panic button, for her in case someone tries to break in and I'm not actually on the premises. If it seems useful, we can wire in pressure mats for selected doorways, both here and at your place. I want us all to keep an eye out for strangers, and that includes the mailman, gas man, delivery people, meter readers, anyone."
He turned to look at me.
"We'll vary your schedule as much as possible. Take a different route to and from the office every day.
I'll be with you for the most part, but I want you to understand the basic strategy. Stay away from public places and public events. By the same token, I don't want you any place isolated or remote.
What about jogging or going to the gym?
Stow that for now. Any guy with a canvas bag could probably walk into the gym.
Should I have a gun?
Henry asked, moving right into cops and robbers mode.
Henry, you hate guns.
It may come to that, but I doubt it,
Deet said to Henry, ignoring me completely.
We're looking at prevention. With luck, we won't have anybody to shoot at.
Hey, excuse me. Do you guys mind if I voice an opinion?
Dietz turned to me.
I said, if the guy in the truck wants to kill me, he'll kill me. I'm willing to be careful, but let's don't go nuts here.
Dietz shook his head.
I disagree. He'll do it if you're foolish and give him the chance, but he's not getting paid enough to stick his neck out.
I turned to Henry, filling him in. He's a cut-rate killer. $1,500. Dietz amplified.
For that kind of money, he's not going to hang around for long. If he's quick about it, it may be worth it to him. Otherwise, forget it. It's not cost-effective.
Yeah, I said. We don't want him to get chewed out by his accountant.
Deet said,
Listen, the guy's trying to make a buck. Every day he's in Santa Teresa, it's costing him something. Food, lodging, gasoline. If he has a kid with him, the expenses mount up.
He was rattling his car keys.
I'm going over to the police station and have a chat with the cops. You have any plans for tonight?
I started to answer when I realized he was talking to Henry. I raised my hand like a school kid. I don't mean to be argumentative, but could I have a vote? I hated being so obnoxious, but this was driving me nuts. These guys were riding right over me. Deet smiled at me briefly.
Sorry, you're right. I have a tendency to overorganize.
I murmured something, backing down, of course. The truth was I didn't have any idea what to do. I just didn't want to be pushed around.
Dietz put his keys in his pocket.
What about groceries? Let me know what we need and I can stop by a supermarket on my way back.
I didn't even have to look. The refrigerator was empty and my cupboards were bare.
Any requests?
Whatever you want. I don't really cook.
Me neither. We'll have to fake it. I want us eating in whenever possible. While I'm gone, please stay here and keep the door locked. We'll set up the alarm in the morning first thing. I don't want you going out, and no answering the phone. You have a machine on it?
I nodded.
Let the machine pick up.
I can stay with her if you think it's wise,
Henry said. Dietz looked at me to check my reaction. The guy was a quick study. I'd have to give him that. I'd like to have some time by myself, I said. Who knew when I'd ever get to be alone again? Dietz was apparently willing to honor the request. Henry offered to cook for us, but I really didn't feel up to it. I was tired. I was sore. I was irritable. I just wanted to grab a quick supper and go to bed. My culinary repertoire was limited to peanut butter and pickle sandwiches and hot sliced hard-boiled egg with lots of mayonnaise and salt. I'd have to quiz Dietz later on his specialties. Surely he could do something. I showered while Dietz was gone, remembering numerous items I wished I'd asked him to pick up. Wine, for one. I gave my hair a quick shampooing, feeling antsy and distracted. The sound of running water masked other sounds in the apartment. Someone could be breaking one of my windows out, and I wouldn't hear it. I should have had Henry babysit. I cut the shower short, wrapped myself in a towel, and peered over the loft railing. Everything looked just as it had before. No broken window, no bloodied hand reaching through to turn the latch. I put on jeans and a fresh shirt, found clean sheets in the linen closet, and made up the sofa bed. It was odd to have a house guest, even in the guise of a bodyguard. I wasn't used to living in the place by myself, let alone with a guy I'd only met that day. I unpacked the duffel and tidied up the living room. Dietz had told me not to answer the telephone, but he hadn't said anything about phoning out. It was only 6:15. I needed the comfort of business as usual. I put a call through to Mrs. Gersh. Irene, this is Kinsey Milhone. I just wanted to touch base and check on your mother. Is she up here yet?
How nice of you. Yes, she is. Mother arrived about 3 this afternoon, she said. We had an ambulance meet her at the airport and take her right to the nursing home. I just got back from seeing her, as a matter of fact, and she seems fine. Tired, of course.
The trip must have been hard on her.
Irene's voice dropped slightly.
They must have sedated her, though nobody said as much. I expected her to be raising Cain, but she was very subdued. At any rate, I can't tell you how grateful I am you were able to locate her, and so quickly, too. Even Clyde seems relieved.
Good, I'm glad. I hope everything works out.
What about you, dear? I heard about your accident. Are you all right?
I squinted at the phone with puzzlement.
You heard about that?
Well, yes, from your associate. He called here this afternoon, wondering when you'd be home.
All of my internal processes came to a dead halt.
What associate?
I don't know, Kinsey. I thought you'd know that. He said he was a partner in your agency. I really didn't catch the name.
A note of doubt had crept into her voice, probably in response to the chilly note in mine.
What time was this?
About an hour ago. I told him I hadn't heard from you, but I was certain you'd be driving back this afternoon. That's when he mentioned that you'd had an accident. Is something wrong?
Irene, I don't have a partner. What I have is some guy hired to kill my ass.
I could practically hear her blink.
I don't understand, dear. What does that mean?
Just what it sounds like, a hitman, someone hoping to murder me for money.
There was a pause, as if she were having to translate from a foreign tongue.
You're joking.
I wish I were.
Well, he seemed to know all about you, and he sounded very nice. I never would have said a word if he hadn't seemed so familiar.
I hope you didn't give him my home address or phone number, I said.
Of course not. If he'd asked me that, I'd have known something was amiss. This is awful. I feel terrible.
Don't worry about it. It's not your fault. If you hear from the guy again or from anyone else, please let me know.
I will. I'm sorry. I had no idea.
I understand. There was no way you could know. Just get in touch with me if you hear from him again.
After I hung up, I went into the downstairs bathroom and stood in the tub, looking out the window at the street. It was not quite dark, that hazy twilight hour when light and shadow begin to merge. Lights in the neighborhood were beginning to come on. A car passed slowly along the street, and I found myself pulling back. I didn't actually whimper, but that's how I felt. It was amazing to me how quickly I was losing my nerve. I consider myself a capable person. Ballsy is the word that comes to mind, but I didn't like the idea of this guy breathing down my neck. I returned to the living room, where I circled restlessly in a space scarcely bigger than a 9x12 rug. At 6:45 there was a tap at the door. My heart volunteered an extra beat just to speed the adrenaline along. I peered through the porthole. Dietz was standing on the doorstep, his arms loaded with groceries. I unlocked the door and let him in. I took one bag of groceries while he put the other on the kitchen counter. I'm not sure what expression I had on my face, but he picked up on it.
What's wrong?
My voice sounded abnormal, even to my own ears.
Some guy called the woman I was working for and asked about me. He told her about the accident and asked if I was back in town yet.
Dietz's hand moved toward the pocket where he'd kept his cigarettes. He flashed a look of annoyance, apparently meant for himself.
How'd he know about her?
I have no idea.
Shit.
What did the cops have to say?
Not much. At least they know now what's going on. They'll have the beat car cruise by at intervals.
Whoopee-doo!
Cut the sarcasm, he said irritably.
Sorry, I didn't know it would come out like that. He turned back to one of the grocery bags, pulling out a garment that looked like the blue vests we'd worn in high school sports to distinguish one team from another.
Lieutenant Dolan suggested you wear this. It's a bulletproof vest, a man's, but it should do the job. Some rookie left it behind when he quit the force.
I took the thing, holding it up by one Velcro strap. It was heavier than it looked, and it had all the sex appeal of an ace bandage.
What about you? Don't you need one of these?
Dietz was taking his jacket off.
I've got one in the car. I'm going to clean up. We'll talk about supper in a bit.
I put groceries away while he showered in the downstairs bathroom. Judging from the items he'd bought, he must have snagged two each from every department he passed. I hadn't been in the apartment long enough to decide where anything should go, so I amused myself with paper goods and staples, cans, condiments, spices, and household cleaners. Fortunately, he'd had the presence of mind to buy a bottle of Jack Daniels, two bottles of white wine, and a six-pack of beer. I'm ashamed to say how cheered I was by the sight. Given my current level of anxiety, I wasn't above a nip of alcohol. I put the beer away and got out the corkscrew. The bathroom door opened and Dietz came out, dressed in jeans and a dress shirt, his feet bare, the scent of aftershave wafting toward me in a cloud. He was toweling his hair dry, and it stood out around his head like straw. The gray in his eyes was as clean as ice. He spotted the radio on the kitchen counter and turned it on, tuning in a country western song with lots of major chords and a rocking horse rhythm that would probably drive me mad. My problem with country music is that I try to avoid the very situations the lyrics lament. However, having objected to his cigarettes, I didn't feel comfortable protesting his taste in music as well. He probably wasn't any happier with the proximity than I was. I poured wine in a glass. Want some?
Of course.
I handed him the glass of wine and poured a second for myself. I felt like we should drink a toast to something, but I couldn't think what. Are you hungry? I noticed you picked up some bacon and eggs. We could have that if you like.
Fine. I wasn't sure what else to get. I hope you're not a vegetarian. I should have asked.
I eat anything. Well, except tripe, I said. I set the wine glass on the counter so I could get out the eggs. Scrambled all right? I'm terrible at fried.
I can cook 'em.
I don't mind.
It shouldn't be your responsibility. I'm not here as a guest.
I hate bickering about who's going to be nicer. I got out the skillet and tried a new subject. We never talked about money. Lee didn't mention your hourly rate.
Let's not worry about that. We'll work something out.
I'd feel better if we came to some arrangement.
What for?
I shrugged. I don't know, I said. It's just more businesslike.
I don't want to charge you. I'm doing this for fun.
I turned and stared at him. You think this is fun?
You know what I mean. I've chucked the business anyway, so this one's on me.
I don't like that, I said. I know you mean well, and believe me, I appreciate the help, but I don't like to feel indebted.
There's no debt implied.
I'm going to pay you, I said testily.
Great. You do that. My rates just went up. $500 an hour.
I stared at him, and he stared back. That's bullshit.
That's my point. It's bullshit. We'll work something out. Right now, I'm hungry, so let's quit arguing.
I turned back to the skillet with a shake of my head. The joy of being single is you always get to have your own way. I went up to bed at 9, exhausted. I slept fitfully, aware that Dietz was up and prowling restlessly well into the night. Chapter 11. I woke automatically at 6 o'clock a.m. and rolled out of bed for my early morning run. Oh, wow, shit, hurt. I was sucking air through my teeth, on my hands and knees, staring at the floor when I remembered Dietz's advisory. No jogging, no lifting weights. He hadn't said a word about getting out of bed. I was clearly in no condition to work out anyway. The second day of anything is always the worst. I staggered to my feet and hobbled over to the loft rail, peering down at the living room. He was up. The sofa bed had been remade. I caught the smell of fresh coffee and a glimpse of him sitting at the kitchen counter with the L.A. Times open in front of him, probably wishing he could have his first cigarette of the day. From my perspective, foreshortened, his face seemed to be dominated by his furrowed brow and jutting chin, his body top-heavy with bulky shoulders and biceps. He reversed the pages, flipping to the middle of the metro section, which is where all the juicy Los Angeles crime is detailed. I eased out of his line of sight, climbed into bed again, and spent a few minutes staring up through the skylight. A marine layer had blanketed the plexiglass dome with white. Impossible to tell yet what kind of day it would be. It seldom rains here in May. Chances are the clouds would lift and we'd have sunshine, mild breezes, the usual lush green. Sometimes perfection ain't that easy to bear. Meanwhile, I couldn't lie here all day, though I was tempted, I confess. If I went downstairs, I'd have to be polite and interact with Dietz, making small talk of some as yet undetermined sort. New relationships are daunting, even when they're short-term. People have to trade all those tedious details about their previous lives. It made me tired to consider the sheer weight of the exchange. We'd touched on the preliminaries in the car coming home, but we had reams of data to cover yet. Chit-chat aside, Dietz might turn on the radio again. More Roy Orbison. I couldn't face that at 6:05 a.m. On the other hand, it was my house and I was hungry, so why shouldn't I go downstairs and eat? I didn't have to talk to him. I pushed the covers back and got up, limped into the bathroom and brushed my teeth. My face was still a technicolor wonder, a rainbow of bruises after a shower of blows. I wiggled my eyebrows and studied myself. The contusion on my forehead was shifting subtly from dark blue to gray, my blackened eyes lightening from lavender to an eerie green. I've seen eyeshadow in the same shade, and it always puzzles me why women want to look like that. I got belted in the chops last night, is what it says. My hair was, as usual, mashed from the night's sleep. I'd showered the night before, but I hopped in again, not for the sake of cleanliness, but hoping to improve my mood. Having Dietz under the same roof was making my skin itch. Once I pulled on jeans and an old sweatshirt, I dumped my dirty clothes in the hamper, tucked the empty duffel in the closet, and made the bed. I went downstairs. Dietz murmured a good morning without lifting his eyes from the sports page. I helped myself to some coffee, poured a bowl of cereal with milk, grabbed the funnies, and toted it all into the living room, where I sat, bowl in hand, spooning cereal into my mouth absent-mindedly while I read the comic page. The funnies never make me laugh, but I read them anyway in hopes. I caught up with Rex Morgan, M.D., the girls in Apartment 3G, and Mary Worth. It's comforting how slowly life moves in a comic strip. I hadn't read the paper in maybe 4 days, and the professor was just now looking startled at something Mary'd said to him. What a wag she was! I could tell he was disconcerted by the wavy lines around his head. Dimly, I was aware that Dietz had opened the front door and stepped out into the backyard. When I finished my cereal, I washed my bowl and spoon and left them in the dish rack. Hesitantly, I moved to the front door and peered out, feeling like a housebound cat discovering that a door has inadvertently been left ajar. Was I allowed outside? The marine layer was already beginning to dissipate, but the yard had that bleached look that a mist imparts. The foghorn was bleating intermittently, a calf separated from its mother, in the still morning air. The strong scent of seawater saturated the yard. Sometimes I half expect the surf to be lapping at the curb out front. Dietz was hunkering near the flower beds. Henry had put in some bare root roses the year before, and they were in full bloom. Sonia, Park Place, Lady X, names giving no clue about the final effect.
"Aphids," he said. "He should buy some ladybugs."
I leaned against the doorframe, too paranoid to venture all the way out into the yard. "Are we going to talk about security again, or did we cover it last night?" He got to his feet, turning his attention to me.
"We should probably discuss your schedule. Any standing appointments? Massage? Beauty salon?"
"Do I look like someone with a standing appointment at a beauty salon?" He studied my face with curiosity, but refrained from comment.
"The point is, we don't want your movements predictable."
I rubbed my forehead, which was still smarting to the touch. I gathered as much. "Okay, so I cancel my masseuse, bikini wax, and the weekly pedicure. Now what?" He smiled.
"I appreciate your cooperation. Makes my job easier."
"Believe me, I'm not interested in being killed," I said. "I do need to go into the office."
"What time?"
"Doesn't matter. I want to pick up my mail and get some bills paid. Minor stuff, really, but I don't want to put it off."
"No problem. I'd like to see the place."
"Good," I said, turning to go back inside.
"Kinsey, don't forget the body armor."
"Right. Make sure you wear yours, too." Upstairs, I dutifully stripped off my sweatshirt and slipped on the bulletproof vest, pressing the Velcro straps into place. Dietz had told me this particular vest offered threat level 1 protection, which was good against a 38 special or less. Apparently, he was assuming a hitman wouldn't use a 9mm automatic. I tried not to think about garrots, head wounds, blasted kneecaps, the penetrating power of ice picks, any one of a number of assaults not covered by the oversized bib I wore.
"Make sure it's tight enough," Dietz had called up from below.
"Got it," I said. I had pulled the sweatshirt on over the vest and checked myself in the mirror. I looked like I was 11 years old again. At 8:45, we moved through the front gate. Dietz had gone out first to check the car and scan the street. He returned, motioning me forward. He walked slightly in front of me, his stride brisk, his eyes alert as we traversed the 50 paces to his Porsche. The whole maneuver had an urgency about it that made me feel like a rock star. "I thought a bodyguard was supposed to be inconspicuous," I said.
"That's one theory."
"Won't everybody guess?"
He looked over at me. "Let's put it this way. I'm not interested in advertising what I do, but if this guy's watching us, I want him to understand just how hard his job is going to be. Most attacks occur suddenly and at very close range. I'll try not to be obnoxious, but I'm sticking to you like glue."
Well, that answered that. Dietz drove with his usual determination. He was a real A-type personality, one of those guys who lives like he's always late for some appointment, irritated at anybody who slows him down. Bad drivers caught him by surprise, as though they were the exception instead of the rule. I directed him to the downtown area, which, fortunately, was only 10 minutes away. If he noticed I was bracing myself between the dashboard and the doorframe, he didn't mention it. At the entrance to the parking lot, he slowed the car, surveying the layout.
"Is this where you usually park?"
"Sure, the office is right up there." I watched him calculate. He was clearly hoping for a way to change my routine, but parking farther away was only going to make the walk longer, thus exposing us for an extended period.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
I watched him calculate. He was clearly hoping for a way to change my routine, but parking farther away was only going to make the walk longer, thus exposing us for an extended period. He pulled in, handed me the ticket, and found a parking space.
"Anything looks weird," he said. "Speak up right away. Any sign of trouble, we'll get the fuck out."
"Right," I said. It was amazing what this we business was doing to my head. I wasn't famous for letting guys tell me what to do, and I was hoping I wouldn't get used to it. Again, he came around to the passenger side and opened the door, his gaze sweeping the lot as I emerged into the open air. He took my elbow, walking me rapidly across the lot to the back stairs. I wanted to laugh. It felt like having a parent march you up to your room. He entered the building first. The second-floor corridor was deserted. California Fidelity offices weren't open yet. I unlocked my office door. Dietz stepped in ahead of me and took a quick look around, making sure there weren't any goons lurking behind the furniture. He scooped up the mail that had piled up on the floor just under the slot. He sorted through it quickly.
"Let me tell you what we're looking for, in case I'm not here to do this. An unfamiliar return address or one done by hand. Anything marked personal. Extra postage due to weight, oil stains."
"A bulky package with a fuse hanging out the side," I said. He handed me the stack, his expression bland. It's hard to warm to somebody who looks at you that way. Apparently, he didn't think I was as funny as I thought I was. I took the stack of mail and sorted through it as he had. Much of it was third class, but I did have a few checks coming in, all with return addresses I could identify on sight. Together, we listened to the few messages on my machine. None were threatening. Dietz wanted time to acquaint himself with the building and its environs, so he went off to inspect the premises while I put on a pot of coffee. I opened the French doors and paused, suddenly reluctant to step out on the balcony. Across the street I could see the tiers of the parking garage, and it occurred to me that anyone could drive up two levels, park, and get a bead on me. I wasn't even sure a high-powered rifle would be required. You could almost throw a rock from there and pop me in the noggin. I stepped away from the doors, withdrawing into the shadowy safety of the office. I really hated this. At 9:05, I put a call through to my insurance agent and reported the accident. She said there was no blue book on the VW because of its age. It looked like I was going to be lucky if I picked up $200 on the claim, so there was no point in having the car towed. Finding an adjuster in Brawley who would go out and take a look was almost more trouble than the car was worth. She said she'd check into it and get back to me. This conversation failed to fill me with happiness. I have a savings account, but the purchase of a car would seriously deplete my funds. Dietz returned to the office in time to intercept Vera, who had stopped in to say hello on her way into the office next door.
"My God, what happened to you?" she said when she saw my face.
"My car ended up in an irrigation ditch down in Brawley," I said. "This is Robert Dietz. He was nice enough to drive me back. Vera Lipton from the offices next door." They shook hands briefly. She was wearing a black leather miniskirt that fit her like automobile upholstery and made a creaking sound when she eased into one of my client chairs. Dietz moved over and parked a hip on the edge of my desk. It was amusing to watch them size each other up. Unknown to Vera, Dietz was viewing her as a potential assassin, while I suspect she was evaluating his qualifications for a role in the hay. Whether hers or mine, I couldn't say. From her expression, she assumed he'd picked me up hitchhiking, and since she considers me hopelessly conservative when it comes to men, I thought the possibility might lend me a certain stature in her eyes. I tried to look like the kind of woman who'd flag down a stranger on the road, but she wasn't interested in me. She was studying him. I was going to have to call this doctor friend of hers so we could double date. She reached into her handbag automatically and pulled a cigarette from a pack of Virginia Slims.
"I'm not smoking this. I just need to hold it," she said when she caught my look.
"I quit last week," she added in an aside to him. I glanced at Dietz to see what his reaction would be. He hadn't had a cigarette now for over 24 hours. A personal best, perhaps. Fortunately, he seemed to be sidetracked by the pheromones wafting through the air like perfume. Vera didn't actually drape one long leg across the chair arm, but there was something provocative about the way she sat. As often as I've seen her operate, I've still never figured out exactly what she does. Whatever the behavior, most men will begin to sit, lie down, and fetch like trained pups.
"I hope you're not forgetting the dinner tomorrow night," she said.
She knew from my face I hadn't the faintest idea what she was talking about.
"For Jewel. Retirement,"
she said, keeping it simple for those of us who'd suffered brain damage.
"Oh, that's right. I completely forgot.
Really, I'm sorry, but I just don't see how I can make it," I said, with visual reference to Dietz. He was never going to permit my attendance at a public affair. Vera caught the look and said to Dietz,
"You're invited, of course. Jewel's leaving the company after 25 years. Attendance is mandatory. No ifs, ands, or buts."
"Where's it being held?" he asked.
"The Edgewater Hotel. A private dining room. Should be very elegant. It's costing enough."
"How many people are we talking about?"
Vera shrugged.
"Maybe 35.
"Invitation only?"
"Sure. It's California Fidelity employees and guests. Why?"
"Can't do it," I said.
"I think we can manage it," Dietz said at the same time. "It will help if there's been no advance publicity."
Vera looked from one of us to the other.
"What's going on?"
Dietz filled her in. I waited, feeling oddly irritated, while they went through the catechism of disbelief and assurances. Vera expressed all the requisite attitudes.
"God, that's awful. I can't believe things like that actually go on. Listen, if you guys don't want to risk it, I'll understand."
"I'll want to check it out, but we'll see how it looks. Can we let you know in the morning?"
Dietz said.
"Of course. As long as I know by noon, it shouldn't be any problem."
"What time's the dinner?"
"No host cocktails at 7. The dinner's at 8.
Vera glanced at her watch.
"Oops, I gotta scoot. It's been nice meeting you."
"You too."
She moved toward the door.
"Oh, and Vera," he said, "we'd prefer to keep this quiet."
She pulled her glasses down on her nose, looking at him over the rims. There was an elegant pause while she raised a brow.
"Of course," she said.
The word "asshole" implied. There was something flirtatious in the very way she left the room. Lord, she was really going all out for this guy. Dietz seemed to color. It was the first time I'd seen him disconcerted by anything. The most unlikely men turn out to be suckers for abuse. When the door closed behind her, I turned on Dietz with an outraged tone.
"I thought you said no public events."
"I did. I'm sorry. I can see I caught you by surprise. I don't want to interfere any more than I have to.
If this is something you want, then let's find a way to do it.
I'm not going to risk my life for something like that.
Look, there's no way we can eliminate every possibility of attack. I'm here to reduce the likelihood, that's all. The president goes out in public, for God's sake, he said. His tone shifted. Besides, I'm not convinced the guy we're dealing with is a pro.
Oh, great, he might be a lunatic instead.
Dietz shrugged matter-of-factly. If we play our cards right, you'll be safe enough. The guest list is restricted, and these are people you know. Once we scope it out, the question boils down to, do you want to go or not? You tell me. I'm not here to dictate the terms of your life.
I don't know yet, I said, somewhat mollified. The dinner's no big deal, but it might be nice to be out.
Then let's see what it looks like, and we'll decide after that.
By noon, I'd wrapped up my business and locked my files again.
The phone rang just as Dietz and I were heading out the door. I started to answer, but he held a hand up, stopping me.
He picked it up.
Milhone Investigations.
He listened briefly.
Hold on. He passed the phone to me.
Hello?
Kinsey, this is Irene Gersh. I'm sorry to be a bother. You're busy, I know.
No problem. What's up?
Mother's disappeared. I don't suppose she's been in touch with you.
Well, no, but I'm not sure she'd know who to call if she wanted to. I only saw her twice. How long she been gone?
Nobody really knows. The supervisor at the nursing home swears she was there at breakfast time. An aide took her to the dining room in a wheelchair and then went off to take care of someone else. She told Mother she'd just be a minute, but when she turned around, Mother'd left her wheelchair and had taken off on foot. Nobody dreamed she could get very far. I guess they scoured the building and grounds, and now they've started searching the neighborhood. I'm on my way over, but I thought I'd check with you first, just in case you knew anything.
I'm sorry, but I haven't heard from her at all. You need some help?
No, no. There's really no need at this point. The police have been notified, and they have a patrol car cruising the area. So far there's no sign of her, but I'm sure she'll turn up. I just didn't want to overlook the possibility that she might be with you.
I wish I could be more help. We've got an errand to run, but we can check with you later and see what's going on. Give me the address and telephone number at the nursing home.
I tucked the phone against my shoulder while I made a note on a piece of scratch paper.
I'll give you a call when we get back.
Thank you. I appreciate your concern.
In the meantime, don't worry. I'm sure she's somewhere close.
I hope so.
I told Dietz what was going on as we headed down the back steps. I was half tempted to have him take me over to the nursing home, but it didn't feel like a real emergency. He wanted to see the Edgewater and check the arrangements for the banquet. He suggested I call Irene from the hotel as soon as he was done. It made sense, and I agreed, though I knew for a fact if I were on my own, I'd have done it the other way. I was feeling distracted, and for once his driving style didn't bother me. It was hard to imagine where Agnes could have gone. I knew she was capable of raising hell when it suited her, but Irene had made it sound like she was resigned to the move. I had to shrug to myself. Surely she'd turn up.
Chapter 12.
I leaned my head back on the seat, staring out the car window while Dietz circled the area surrounding the hotel. I could see that he was committing various routes to memory, getting a sense of the sections of the road where we might be vulnerable to attack. I wasn't that interested in attending the dinner. Now that I thought about it, what the hell did I care? Jewel was a nice lady, but I really didn't know her well. I wasn't feeling that good, and, just to get basic, I didn't have a thing to wear. The all-purpose dress, the only one I owned, had been in my car at the time of the accident. In the auto body lot down in Brawley, I remembered packing soggy items in a cardboard box, which hadn't arrived in Santa Teresa yet. When the dress did get here, it was probably going to smell like a swamp, complete with primordial life forms wiggling out of the wet. I could always ask Vera to lend me some rags. She towered over me, outweighing me by a good 20 pounds. But I'd seen her wearing a sequined tunic cut right to her crotch. It would probably hit me at the knee. Not that I could wear a skirt in my current condition, of course. I was sporting a bruised leg that made me look like spoiled fruit. On a more optimistic note, once I strapped on my body armor, what difference would it make that her bazookas were twice the size of mine? Dietz had apparently satisfied himself with the general layout of the neighborhood, and we were getting down to the particulars.
He pulled into the Edgewater parking lot and turned his Porsche over to a parking attendant, passing the guy a folded bill.
"Keep the car up here close, and let me know if anyone takes an interest."
The attendant glanced down at the bill.
"Yes, sir. Hey, sure."
Dietz and I moved toward the entrance.
"Why so quiet?"
he asked as he steered me through the lobby by the elbow, like the rudder of a boat. I pulled my arm away automatically.
"Sorry," I murmured.
"I've been thinking about the banquet, and it's put me in a bad mood."
"Anything I can help with?"
I shook my head. "What's this feel like to you?"
"What, the job?"
"Yeah, trailing around with me everywhere. Doesn't it get on your nerves?"
"I don't have nerves," he said.
I turned and scanned his face, wondering if that was really true. He hunted down the hotel manager and had a long talk with him about the banquet room, the closest medical facility, and matters of that ilk. I would have jettisoned the whole plan, but by now we'd invested so much time and energy, I felt I was obligated to follow through. Meanwhile, Dietz was triggering all the disagreeable aspects of my personality. I was beginning to remember certain personal traits that had probably contributed to my divorces. I prefer to believe it was all their fault, but who are we trying to kid here? I left Dietz in the manager's office and wandered down the corridor. Just off the hotel lobby, there were little shops where rich people browsed, looking for ways to spend money without having to leave the premises. I went into a clothing boutique and circled the place. The merchandise seemed unreal to me, outfits laid out with all the color-coordinated accessories. My notion of accessories is you wear your gym socks with matching rims. The air smelled of one of those movie star perfumes that cost $120 an ounce. Just for laughs, I checked the sale rack. Even marked down, most items cost more than my monthly rent. I crossed to the section where the evening wear was arranged. Long skirts in brocade, tops stiff with sequins, everything embroidered, hand-stitched, hand-painted, appliqued, beaded and otherwise bejeweled. The saleswoman glanced over at me with a practiced smile. I could see her expression falter slightly, and I was reminded yet again how unnerving my appearance must be to those unprepared for it. I was hoping I looked like I'd just had cosmetic surgery. A little nose bob, eye tucks. For all she knew, I was holing up here with some sugar daddy until the swelling went down. Dietz appeared in the doorway, and I moved in his direction. As usual, he grabbed me by the elbow without ceremony and marched me down the hall. He was brusque, distracted, probably mentally several moves ahead.
"Let's have lunch."
"Here?" I said, startled. I'm more the Burger King type myself.
"Sure, why not? It'll cheer you up."
We'd reached the entrance to the hotel restaurant, a vast room enclosed in glass, with polished red tile floors and white wicker furniture. The room was dense with greenery, palms and rubber plants, potted ficuses lending an air of tropical elegance. The patrons were actually very casually dressed, tennis outfits, golf shirts, and designer sweats. Dietz was wearing the same jeans and tweed sport coat he'd worn for 2 days, while I was in my jeans and tennis bops. No one seemed to pay the slightest attention to us, except for the occasional look of curiosity that flickered to my face. He spotted a sheltered table near a fire exit, with a sign prominently displayed above it. "This door must be kept unlocked during business hours." Perfect if needed to make a fast getaway. The service area nearby was being used as a station for linen and flatware. A waitress had been sentenced to folding napkins into cloth boats.
"How about that one?" he said.
The hostess nodded and led the way, showing us to our seats without questioning his taste. She handed us 2 oversized menus bound in leather.
"Your waiter will be right with you," she said and moved away.
I'll admit I checked the menu with a certain curiosity. I'm used to fast food chains where the menus feature glossy photos of the food, as if the reality itself is bound to disappoint. The edibles here were itemized on a quarto of parchment, handwritten by some kitchen scribe who had mastered food speak. Lightly sauced pan-smoked fillets of free-range veal in a crib of fresh phyllo, topped with squaw bushberries and accompanied by hand-formed gaufrettes of goat cheese, wild mushrooms, yampa root, and fresh herbs. $21.95. I glanced at Dietz, who didn't seem at all dismayed. As usual, I could tell I was completely out of my element. I hardly ever eat squaw bushberries and yampa root. I checked the other patrons. My view was actually half obscured by a Boston fern. Next to the plant stand was a cylindrical cage in which finches were twittering. There were small bamboo baskets affixed to the wire sides, and the little birds hopped in and out with strips of newspaper, making nests. There was something charming about their bright-eyed busyness. Dietz and I watched them idly while we waited for our waiter.
"You know anything about crows?" he asked.
"I'm not much on birds."
"I wasn't either until I met one personally. I used to have a crow named Albert, Birdie, when I got to know him better. I got him when he was just a little guy and had him for years. A young crow doesn't navigate well, and they'll sometimes crash land. They're called branchers at that age. That's about all they can do, lumber awkwardly from branch to branch. Sometimes they get stuck, and they wail like babies until you get them down. Birdie must have bitten off a bit more than he could chew when he tumbled to the ground. I had a cat named Little John who brought him in, squawking hellishly. LJ and I had a tussle to see who was going to take possession. Fortunately for Birdie, I won the contest. He and the cat became friends later, but it was touch and go for a while there. LJ was pissed off because he thought this was Thanksgiving dinner and I was getting in his way.
Dietz looked up. The waiter was approaching, dressed like an usher at a wedding, complete with white gloves.
"Good afternoon. Something to drink before lunch?"
The waiter's manner was circumspect, and he avoided making eye contact. Dietz turned to me.
"You want a drink?"
"White wine," I said.
"Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc?"
the waiter asked.
"Chardonnay." "And you, sir?"
"I'll have a beer. What do you have imported?"
"Amstel, Heineken, Beck's Dark, Beck's Light, Dos Equis, Bohemia, Corona."
"Beck's Light," Dietz said.
"Are you ready to order?"
"No." The waiter stared at Dietz, then nodded and withdrew. Dietz said,
"We probably won't see him for half an hour, but I hate being bullied into ordering."
He picked up his story again about Birdie the Crow, who liked to take long walks on foot and lived on a diet of M&Ms, hard-boiled eggs, and dry cat food. While Dietz talked, his gaze shifted restlessly around the room. He seldom looked at faces, always at hands, checking for concealed weapons, sudden movements, signals perhaps. Some underling arrived, bearing our drinks, but the waiter didn't return. Dietz scanned the dining room, but there was no sign of him. 20 minutes passed. I could see Dietz take note, and in a surge of uneasiness he finally tossed a bill on the table and got up.
"Let's get out of here. I don't like this."
"Do you see everything as part of some plot?" I asked, trotting after him.
"That may be all that keeps the two of us alive."
I shrugged to myself and let it go at that. When we reached the front entrance, the Porsche was parked right up against the shrubs. He snagged the keys off the board himself and helped me into the car. He got in on his side and fired up the engine. We drove home along the beach. I was exhausted and my head was starting to pound. When we got to my apartment, Dietz hauled out his portable alarm system, which he showed me how to arm and disarm. He affixed it to the door.
"I'll tell Henry to keep an ear tuned while I'm out."
"You're going off somewhere?" I felt a little bubble of panic arise, testimony to how quickly I'd come to depend on him for my sense of personal safety.
"I want to have another chat with Lieutenant Dolan. He said he'd talk to the Carson City DA and try to get an ID on this guy with the kid. Somebody must have heard of him. Maybe we can pick up a mug shot and at least figure out what he looks like. I'll be back in half an hour. You'll be fine here. Get some rest. You look beat."
He took off while I downed a pain pill and headed up to the loft. I had promised to call Irene, and I could feel the tiny voice of my conscience whining deep within. The phone rang just as I was pulling off my shoes. Dietz had told me not to answer it if he wasn't there, but I couldn't help myself. I leaned across the bed and picked up the receiver. It was Irene Gersh.
"Oh, good, it's you. I'm calling from the nursing home. I'm so glad you're there. I was afraid you were still out."
"We just got in. I was thinking I should call you, but I hadn't worked up the energy."
"Is this a bad time?"
"It's fine. Don't worry about it. What's happening?"
"'Nothing, that's the point. I'm sorry to be such a pest, but I'm just beside myself. Mother's been gone now for 8 hours, and there's simply no sign of her. Clyde feels maybe we should get out and check the neighborhood ourselves.'
"'Sounds smart,' I said. "'You need any help knocking on doors?' In that split second, my concern for Agnes's safety overrode my worries about myself.
"'Thank you. We'd appreciate it. The longer Mother's on the loose, the more frightened I get. Somebody must have seen her.'
"'You'd think so,' I said. "'When do you need me there?'
"'Soon, if you could. Clyde called from work, and he's on his way over now. If it's not too much trouble—'
She gave me an address in the 1100 block of Concord. "'I'm on my way,' I said, and hung up. I put a quick call through to Lieutenant Dolan's office and left word for Dietz to meet me at the nursing home, reiterating the address. That done, I picked my way carefully down the stairs. I craved action. My whole body was seizing up in the wake of the accident, and my joints felt stiff with rust. Certain postures caused excruciating pains to shoot through my neck, causing me to murmur, "Ow, ow, ow." I was hoping the painkiller would do its work before long. I found a jacket and my handbag, checked to make sure my little .32 was accounted for, and headed for the door, searching for my car keys in the outside leather pouch. Where the hell were they? I stopped dead, perplexed, and then it dawned on me. I didn't have transportation. My VW was still down in Brawley at the auto body shop. Well, hell, I thought. I turned on my heel, picked up the phone again, and called a cab. By that point, I had already begun to internalize some of Dietz's precautions. I knew better than to loiter outside on the curb in plain sight. I waited, dutifully standing in the tub in the downstairs bathroom, where I could look out the window until the cab appeared in front. For the second time, I snatched up my jacket and my handbag. When I opened the front door, the alarm system went off, scaring me so badly that I nearly wet my pants. Henry's back door banged open, and he came running out with a meat cleaver in his hand. All he had on was a pair of turquoise briefs, and his face was pale as bread dough.
"'My God, what happened? Are you all right?'
"'Henry, I'm fine. I accidentally set off the alarm.'
"'Well, get back inside. You scared the hell out of me. I was about to take a shower when that damn thing went off. Why are you out here? Dietz said you were napping. You look awful. Go to bed.'
His panic had rendered him a little cranky, I thought.
"'Would you quit worrying? There's no cause for hysteria.'
"'Irene Gersh called me, and I'm on my way over to the nursing home to help look for her mom. I've got a cab waiting out in front.' Henry grabbed my jacket.
"'You'll do no such thing,' he said snappishly. "'You can wait till Dietz gets back and go over there with him.'
I could feel my temper climb in response to his. I grabbed the jacket back, the two of us tugging like kids in a schoolyard. The cleaver he was holding made it treacherous work. The second time he reached for the jacket, I held it up and away from him. "'Henry,' I said warningly, "'I am a free human being. Dietz knows I'm going over there. I called Dolan's office and talked to him myself. He's on his way.'
"'You did not. I know you. You're lying through your teeth,' Henry said.
"'I did call.
But you didn't talk to him.
I left a message that's just as good.
What if he never gets it?'
Then you can tell him where I am. I'm going.
No, you're not.
I had to argue for 5 minutes before I was allowed to leave the premises. Meanwhile, the cab driver had already tooted twice, and he appeared from around the corner looking for his fare. I don't know what he must have thought when he caught sight of us, me with my battered face, Henry in his Calvin Klein skivvies with a cleaver in his mitt. Fortunately, Henry knew the guy, and after earnest reassurances on all sides, he finally consented to my departure. He didn't like the idea, but there wasn't much he could do. The cabbie was still shaking his head with mock disgust.
"'Get some pants on, Pitts. You could get arrested like that.'
By the time I reached the nursing home on the Upper East Side, it was nearly 2 o'clock. I realized as the cab pulled up that I knew the neighborhood. Rosie and I had combed the entire area, looking for a board and care for her sister Clotilda. The houses, for the most part, were built on a grand scale, rambling interiors with high ceilings, oversized windows, wide porches, surrounded by massive oaks and old shaggy palms. In contrast, the nursing home from which Agnes had disappeared was a two-story Victorian structure with a carriage house in the rear. The frame siding was a pale gray, with the trim done in fresh white. The steeply pitched roof was made of slate tiles,
overlapping like fish scales. At the second-story level, a raw-looking L of decking and a set of wooden stairs had been added as a fire escape. The house sat on a large corner lot, the property shaded by countless trees, dotted with flower beds and bordered with shrubs, which were pierced by the protruding upright arrows of an ornamental iron fence. There were several cars visible in the small parking lot in the rear. Irene had apparently been watching for my arrival. I paid the driver and emerged from the cab in time to see her moving toward me down the front walk, followed by a gentleman I assumed was Clyde Gersh. Again I was struck by the aura of illness that surrounded her. She was stick-thin and seemed unsteady on her feet. The shirtwaist dress she wore was a jade-green silk that only emphasized the unearthly pallor of her skin. She'd clearly gone to some trouble with her appearance, but the effect was stark. Her foundation makeup was too peachy a shade, and the false lashes made her eyes jump out of her face. A swath of blusher high on each cheek gave her the look of someone in the throes of a fever.
"Oh, Kinsey, God bless you."
She reached for me with trembling hands that were cold to the touch. "How are you, Irene? Is there any sign of her?"
"I'm afraid not. The police have taken the report and they've issued one of those... Oh, what do you call them?"
Clyde spoke up. "A be-on-the-lookout bulletin."
"Yes, that's it. Anyway, they'll have a patrol car cruising the neighborhood. I'm not sure what else they can do for the time being. I'm just sick."
Clyde spoke up again, extending his hand.
"Clyde Gersh."
Irene seemed flustered.
"Oh, I'm sorry. This is Miss Milhone. I don't know what I was thinking of."
Clyde Gersh was probably in his late 50s, some 10 years older than his wife. He was tall and stooped, wearing an expensive-looking suit that seemed to hang on his frame. He had a thinning head of gray hair, a lined face, his brow knotted with concern. His features had the droopy quality of a man resigned to his fate. His wife's state of health, whether real or self-induced, must have been a trial to him. He'd adopted an air of weary patience. I realized I had no idea what he did for a living, something that entailed a flexible schedule and wingtip shoes. A lawyer? Accountant? The two of us shook hands. He said, "Nice to meet you, Miss Milhone. I'm sorry for the circumstances." "Me too. I prefer Kinsey, if you would. What can I do to help?" He glanced apologetically at his wife. "We were just discussing that. I'm trying to talk Irene into staying here. She can hold down the fort while we get out and bump doors. I told the director of this two-bit establishment he'll have a lawsuit on his hands if anything's happened to Agnes."
Irene shot him a look. "We can talk about this later," she said to him, and to me. "The nursing home has been wonderful. They feel Mother was probably confused. You know how willful she is, but I'm sure she's fine."
"Of course she is," I said, though I had my doubts. Clyde's expression indicated he had about as much faith as I did. "I'm just heading out if you'd care to join me," he said. "I think we should check the houses along Concord as far as Molina and then head north." Irene spoke up.
"I want to come, Clyde. I won't stay here by myself."
An expression of exasperation flickered briefly in his face, but he nodded agreement. Whatever opposition he may have previously voiced, he now set aside, perhaps in deference to me. He reminded me of a parent reluctant to discipline a kid in front of company. The man wanted to look good. I glanced along the street for some sign of Dietz. Irene caught my hesitation.
"Something wrong, dear? You seem worried."
"Someone's meeting me here. I don't want to take off without leaving word."
"We can wait if you like."
Clyde gestured impatiently. "You two do what you want. I'm going on," he said. "I'll take this side and you can take that. We'll meet here in 30 minutes and see how it looks." He gave Irene's cheek a perfunctory kiss before he headed off. She stared after him anxiously. I thought she was going to say something, but she let the moment pass.
"Would you like to tell someone at the nursing home where we'll be?"
"Never mind," I said. "Dietz will figure it out." Chapter 13. We started with the house diagonally across from the nursing home. Like many others in the neighborhood, it was substantially constructed, probably built in the early years of the century. The facade was wide, the two-story exterior shingled in cedar tinted with a pale green wash. A prominent gabled porch sat squarely in the center,
matching large bay windows, reflecting blankly the sprawling branches of an overhanging oak. I thought I saw movement in an upstairs window as we came up the walk. Irene was clinging to my arm for support. Already I could tell she was going to slow me down, but I didn't have the heart to mention it. I was hoping her anxiety would ease if she could help in the search. I pressed the bell, which jangled harshly. Moments later, the front door opened a crack, and a face appeared, an older woman. The burglar chain was still judiciously in evidence. Had I been a thug, I could have kicked the door open with a well-placed boot.
"Yes," I said. "Sorry to bother you, but we're talking to everybody in the neighborhood. An elderly woman's disappeared from the nursing home across the street, and we're wondering if you might have seen her. About 7 this morning? We think that's when she left."
"I don't get up until 8 o'clock these days. Doctor's orders. I used to get up at 5, but he says that's ridiculous. I'm 76. He says there's nothing going on at that hour that I need to know about."
"What about your neighbors? Have you heard anybody mention—"
She waved an impatient hand, knuckles speckled and thick.
"I don't talk to them. They haven't cut that hedge in the last 15 years. I paid the paper boy to come in once a month and trim it up. Otherwise it'd grow clear up through the telephone wires. They have a dog comes over in my yard, too. Does his business everywhere. I can't step a foot out without getting dog duty on my shoe. My husband's always saying, 'P.U., Ethel, there's dog duty on your shoe again.'"
I took out one of my business cards, jotting the number of the nursing home on the back.
"Could I leave you my card? That way, if you hear anything, you can give me a call. We'd appreciate your help."
The woman took it reluctantly. It was clear she didn't have much interest in geriatric runaways.
"What's this woman's name?"
"Agnes Gray."
"What's she look like? I can't very well identify someone I've never laid eyes on before."
I described Agnes briefly. With Irene standing there, I couldn't very well suggest that Agnes looked like an ostrich.
"I'll keep an eye out," she said, and then the door closed.
We tried the next house, and the next, with about the same results. By the time we reached the corner, 45 minutes had gone by. It was slow work, and so far unproductive. No one had seen Agnes. We headed east on Concord. A UPS truck approached, and we waited on the curb until we'd seen it pass. I put a hand under Irene's arm as we crossed the street, supervising her safety as Dietz supervised mine. A fine tremor seemed to be vibrating through the dark green silk of her dress. I studied her uneasily. Years of bleaching had left her hair a harsh white blonde, very thin, as if she'd succeeded finally in eliminating any whisper of color from the wispy strands. She had no brows to speak of, just 2 brown lines she'd penciled in by hand, wide arcs like a child might have drawn on a happy face. I could see that she might have been considered a beauty once upon a time. Her features were fine, the blue eyes unusual in their clarity. One of her false lashes had come loose, sticking out like a tiny